What's up, people? I'm Erica, and this is Cocktails and Capitalism, a podcast that pairs crafted beverages with stories distilled from our capitalist hellscape. We're joined by Ray Abalea, a lead trainer and a fearless coordinator with Beautiful Trouble, a global network of organizers, artists, trainers, and writers working to equip social movements with strategic tools and training to help grassroots movements be more creative, effective, and irresistible. Ray also facilitates workshops with the Nature Conservancy Agility Lab, and she also was the former co-director of Code Pink, which is a feminist grassroots organization working to end U.S. warfare and imperialism, support peace and human rights initiatives, and redirect resources into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life-affirming programs. So you've done so much incredible work, Ray, and I'm so, so glad to have you on the show. Welcome to Cocktails and Capitalism. How you doing?
Thanks, Erica. I'm showing up grateful to be here, brokenhearted about what's going on in the world, and super excited to talk about Beautiful Trouble. So thanks for having us.
Oh, yeah. Cheers to that. And on that note, we've got an amazing cocktail for today. It is called The Beautiful Sunrise, and it is made from mezcal, Aperol, blue curacao, lime juice, soda water, and a pinch of salt. You can see it here. It is it's a blue drink once it mixes in with the rest of the drink, but you're supposed to float the blue curacao so that it's red on the bottom. Yeah, there's your drink. Nice. Cheers.
Cheers.
It's delightful.
Very tasty.
I love the mezcal and the Aperol. It's so good. And Jesse Torres is actually working on a non-alcoholic version of this as well, which is a little bit of a stretch since so many of the ingredients were alcohol, but he's going to figure it out. Did you want to tell people anything about some of the preferences that you had when we were making this cocktail, like using the mezcal?
Yeah. So I love what Jesse has done with our kind of taste notes, if you will, for this first time ever Beautiful Trouble cocktail. As you mentioned, it's kind of a twist on the Tequila Sunrise, and also incorporates this drink called the Paper Plane. And I think that's meant to bring out Beautiful Trouble's signature colors. We have this rainbow that you can see at our website, beautifultrouble.org. And that's meant to symbolize a rainbow of ideas, right? Mm. And it alludes these feelings of like beauty, joy, creativity. And there's soda water in there for the bubbling revolution. And mezcal is a nod to some of Beautiful Trouble's roots in Oaxaca. We've hosted numerous Beautiful Trouble workshops in Oaxaca, and it's also where the co-editors went to do the final editing and writing on the book called Beautiful Trouble, which we'll talk about more later. And the cross with the paper plane, I think, is about Beautiful Trouble, you know, starting as a book and being made of paper, literally. And then the way that that book has really taken flight out in the world as a project in many different ways, and hopefully inspiring lots of creative direct actions that fuel real change. So a plane takes us from one place to another, connecting people. And the image of a paper plane also captures ideas that you know, you don't need much to create something that can fly. You know, anyone can do it. Or as we say in one of our Beautiful Trouble principles, anyone can act. And you can imagine a kid kind of throwing a paper plane during class and creating a disruption in a nonviolent creative way. So you guys really got it all in there. I personally always want to have a non-alcoholic option of any cocktail. I love that mocktails are like a fashion and mm-hmm. a rage nowadays. That's about accessibility. That's about meeting people where they're at. I mean, maybe that's also about acknowledging that a lot of times, frankly, cocktails and drinking is a big capitalist enterprise.
Yeah,
a lot of
definitely.
Money and is like inaccessible. And that alcoholism and problems with alcohol can be really real, right? So I love the mocktail version. And I think the fact that the drink has these orange notes and cloves is maybe a nod to a drink I just learned about on an activist trip to Kenya called Dawa. And it's also called Tesh, but it's a drink that's like an immunity booster. And it has orange and clove, and it makes me think about like fire cider and
nice.
Like how do we do immunity boosting and reference tonics and plant medicines in ways that are really useful to keep us resilient and healthy for the long haul as we're going about this work to dismantle unjust structures. And so, yeah, dawa means medicine or magic potion in Swahili, I believe. So, you know, cure all for what ails us. So I kind of have a nod to those both. And I have this, you know, drink where I tried to follow the recipe exactly and it didn't turn out the way I wanted. And that's real, right? Sometimes, you know, we can't have a perfect recipe for creating change. There's twists and turns along the way. And then I took out an ingredient and came up with something kind of more beautiful, equally as tasty. But just to say that, you know, different ingredients work in different communities, or there's different risks for different people that are doing different kinds of actions. So I love the kind of symbolism of these two. And for folks who are listening, I have a orange here that has cloves studded in this half slice, half moon shaped slice of orange. And that looks to me like a spectrum of allies. And if folks don't know what a spectrum of allies is, we can get into that later. But basically, it's a great tool for understanding who you want to most engage with to build the audience for your campaign so that you can win, and how to not waste your time talking with people who maybe are at the opposite side of the spectrum and aren't going to move much.
Yeah.
So we have a little half slice of Spectrum of Allies here in the cocktail.
Beautiful. I love it. That's so perfect. Wow. You did such a wonderful job of explaining all of the different kind of components that we weave together into this drink. And I was so happy that the Beautiful Trouble team had so much amazing input about this because, yeah, it became such a beautiful co-creation that we made. I'm curious, though, what is in the second one? Did you just leave out the blue curacao?
I just left it out because I couldn't get it to float.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
You know, so that's real. And by the way, I put the first one, I put the blue in first, and that's why it mixed so terribly, because you're supposed to put the blue in on the top and have it float. And, you know, we talk a lot in our activist campaign planning about escalating strategically, which means like not jumping to a really intense direct action tactic right away when you're still at the beginning of a campaign. Like, you know, we can imagine if we were an elected official, we might not want someone to come into our office and do a sit-in before they've even tried to have a meeting with us or give us a petition or advocate. So we're slowly and steadily escalating strategically in a way that hopefully our targets and audiences are receptive to and can understand and get on board with. You know, and so that's so important. Which ingredient goes in first actually really matters, and it matters in your recipe. And I'm illustrating that with my gnarly colored drink here.
Yeah, it is kind of gnarly.
Real life organizing.
Yeah. It definitely mixes together into a very strange blue, but I kind of like it. Can you explain a little bit about your background and just anything that you think is really relevant that I left out of my introduction?
I am first generation American who was born in California on unceded Ramaytush Ohlone land. My ancestry is Dutch and Jewish, and that I often think informs my work for dismantling white supremacy. And I have been a troublemaker for the last couple decades in many different social movements, from anti-war to climate justice, and had the opportunity to work with some amazing teachers like the current training director of Beautiful Trouble, Nadine Block, and the co-editor of Beautiful Trouble, Andrew Boyd, and these folks who have really mentored and taught me how to make my voice heard, how to speak truth to power, and how to make change effectively and strategically, and also with beauty and creativity, and hopefully peppered with a little joy in there. So just really, you know, give deep gratitude to my teachers and all those ancestors who have come before us, who have been doing this work a long time, trying to make the world a better place and keep us from veering off the deep end. I do a whole smorgasbord of things these days, from working with a local Latino farm worker led organization called ALAS here in Half Moon Bay, California, where I live, to global organizations like Beautiful Trouble and the Agility Lab. And I appreciate that I get to work across so many different social movements, because I think, you know, one of the theories we have in Beautiful Trouble is intersectionality, which is, you know, really just how we understand how in various forms of injustice are connected. So therefore, our ways of seeking liberation need to be interconnected.
Absolutely. And you folks do such an amazing job of working across social movements, and you in particular, you as an individual do such a beautiful job of that with all the different work that you're doing. So yeah, it's really amazing to connect with someone that is active on the environmental front, on the social justice front, and just, yeah, on the ceasefire front right now. I really appreciate all the intersectionality in what you do and what Beautiful Trouble does. I was hoping that you could offer a little bit of the story of the birth of Beautiful Trouble. Like, how was it created? What spurred people to create this organization?
Actually, Erica, I think that Beautiful Trouble probably started over a conversation on how to overthrow capitalism, likely with drinks in hand. So this podcast feels like very aligned.
Yes, cheers to that.
But seriously, Beautiful Trouble was birthed by seasoned organizers who really wanted to document not only social movement successes, like the case studies or stories, but really dig into what makes an action work. You know, how do we sustain social movements and win campaigns in a big way and make tangible change? So in 2010, which is the year before the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street, there were over 70 artists and activists from across North America and Europe who decided to pool their collective wisdom. And I was one of those people who was asked to contribute to this anthology of writing. And what emerged via many, many Google Docs and collective editing was called Beautiful Trouble, A Toolbox for the Revolution, which is a 500 and some page book with 150 mini chapters, and each one is the size of one tiny action-ready idea. And so it introduces this pattern language where you have these different sections of the book called tactics, principles, theories, and stories. So we weave them together. And so, for example, you want to know, how does this tactic play out in real life? And what principles might be associated with this tactic? You can cross-reference. So it's kind of like the Encyclopedia Britannica on steroids, you could think of, for radical activists wanting to bring more art and creativity into what they're up to. We have chapters like Tactic Flash Mob, or Principle Make the Invisible Visible, or Theory Environmental Justice. So it's this interlinking concepts that help us understand how change happens. Milton Friedman, I'm sure, gets quoted on your podcast quite a bit, the avatar of neoliberalism. And he understood that in a crisis, the politically impossible becomes the politically inevitable. Hmm. So only, he says, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. Right. So yeah, whatever ideas we have lying around, so you can think about Hurricane Katrina and the horrific kind of shock doctrine, as Naomi Klein says, that happened after that, where you have these big developers going in, pushing people off their homes and developing higher income housing. That was an idea that was lying around. How can we capitalize on and make the most money from a crisis? So Beautiful Trouble is basically, we put forth this alternative theory, like a people's shock doctrine, which is, you know, if you have more tools in your tool belt, when a crisis happens, you'll be more equipped to deal with it, and to basically like weather the storm and make real change. And I also think Beautiful Trouble, it's like an ancestral futurism laboratory. Like, we are committed to looking into the past, learning from our elders and our ancestors who have come before us, and to see what worked for them and what didn't, and what can we apply to today. And then we try to look forward and see what stories and tools might equip us for the future, in which we have even more stormy waters ahead, right? Whether we're talking about shrinking commons or expanding warfare or the climate crisis, like, how do we build the world we want to see in the future, and what tools do we need to get there? You know, and on a very practical level, it's like, if the only thing we know how to do as activists is march and rally, then we just do that. Every time we're angry, we just march and rally. And is that going to be the thing that stops the next war? Is that going to be the thing that passes that piece of legislation? You know, in isolation, probably not. We're going to build people power by doing that. We're going to make news headlines, but we need more tools in our toolbox if we want to make effective change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons why I felt so kind of gravitated towards the work that you folks are doing is my background with activism. I tried so many different tactics and strategies to make change, especially while I was a student trying to get the university to divest from the two nuclear weapons design labs in the U.S., doing sit-ins, doing a hunger strike, doing lockdowns and, you know, getting dragged out by the cops and everything. And we never succeeded with that mission of severing ties with the nuclear weapons labs. But after that, I really wanted to go back to the drawing board and figure out, like, why didn't this work? And, you know, what would better practices have been in this case? I didn't have the support at the time to find something like this where I could actually reference all these other ways of approaching a problem, you know. So once I discovered and actually understood the kind of magnitude of what you folks were doing, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so needed. It fills this gap that is so present for people trying to mobilize in different spaces. And it just, yeah, it just really answers so many of my questions that have been burning in me for like years and years and years. So really appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, it's worth saying that there's no one size fits all solution to creating change. I wish there was. I wish we could write a book that was a prescription, because Lord knows we need it. But it's really just this set of tools. And then we see how they work out and we keep learning. And, you know, one of our principles is fail forward, like try things, see if they work, be humble, you know, see if something else works, you know.
That's awesome. Yeah. I would love to hear you describe the Beautiful Trouble Toolkit and the many forms that it has taken over time.
So the book was so well received. We've sold over 25,000 copies to date. It's been translated into 7 languages. Sometimes the book is viewed as contraband or put on, you know, kind of no-fly lists. So there's one version of it that doesn't even have a cover. It just comes with a little sticker that you can stick onto it if you want to reveal the contents that are inside. And we decided to keep the band together and keep going after the book release. And one of the reasons was to get all of the content into an online toolbox under a Creative Commons license, so it could also keep evolving along with the movement it serves. So, you know, if somebody wants to write a new tool and says, hey, you know, you're missing bird dogging as a tactic, you know, and you want to write that up, then get in touch with us. We welcome new submissions. We have this ever-evolving toolbox, and that's now in 9 languages and growing. And we developed a translations team that's really dedicated not just to using AI tools to do translation, but making sure there's a culturally competent, relevant translations of each of our tools. Every time our toolbox is translated, the translators who are activists themselves think about what tools can they add, what stories that are relevant from the countries they're working in to that toolbox. So when we did a workshop in Amman, the workshop in Arabic added the tool Al-Faza'a, which is a surge of solidarity, or the concept of Baltajia, which is, and I'm sure my pronunciation is horrible for anyone listening, my apologies. But the idea of Baltajia, which is the thuggery that often dictators will engage to put down nonviolent protests. So we get these creative concepts that we don't have English language for. You know, the Turkish edition of Beautiful Trouble included this beautiful story of the Gezi Iftar demonstration, where you had people who were observing Ramadan, who were Muslim and praying in the streets, and others who were worried that they might be attacked by police or authorities standing around them, protecting them, all making a beautiful iftar dinner together. So that's how our toolbox keeps growing and expanding in all directions across languages, making it a more accessible platform. You know, here we have this book, Beautiful Trouble. It's flying off the shelves. And a couple years later, we get a call from an organization called ActionAid Denmark. And they're an NGO that supports social movements around the world. And they said, we want a beautiful trouble toolkit that centers stories from the global south and is global in reach. And they supported us to run these jam sessions around the world from Harare to Amman to Oaxaca. It was amazing to be part of those, convening activists to tell their own stories. So this isn't a professor or a mansplainer coming in to tell you about how a social movement works. This is really people telling their own stories and being the agents of their own tools and futures. We had these convenings with frontline activists sharing and documenting their tactics and their winning campaign stories. And the result of that was this more inclusive toolkit called Beautiful Rising, Creative Resistance from the Global South. So that's the sequel to Beautiful Trouble. And in the winter of 2020, amidst the lockdown, we were hard at work combining all these toolkits together. And that's when we released our new website, beautifultrouble.org/toolbox. And constantly adding new tools there all the time. And then to make this wisdom even more accessible to people who came back to us and said, you know, that's nice that you have books, but some people don't like to read books these days. We need it in a more digestible, playful, interactive content. We made a strategy card deck. So we took all these winning principles and tools from the last 100 years of social movement protest and put it into a deck of 99 cards, and you can play Cards for Humanity. Use these cards to design an action on the fly, to do a card storm. I will say we have capitalism as a card in the card deck. One of the theories that we really need to understand and know if we want to create change. And we also have its companion theory, solidarity economics, right? Nice. A different way of organizing cooperatively and justly, and it comes from Latin America. So I love the cards. I think they distill the content down into these little bite-sized descriptions, and then each card also has a QR code so you can get back to that full write-up online. So we hope we're meeting people where they're at to access content. And we've seen over the years, many college professors, including Beautiful Trouble content in their curriculum, and we really want to make sure that it's all licensed under the Creative Commons, so anyone can go on the website, put little hearts next to the tools they like, and then download their own PDF and use it in their own trainings. And you know, it's like steal this curriculum is basically
you steal this book, yeah, totally. Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. Yeah, the fact that you can go onto the website and just build your own toolkit through the site, I started playing around with it and doing that a little bit. It's fascinating and so fun that you can just do that so easily and simply with all of these different strategies and tactics. And you can go either very surface with it, just reading the tiny little blip about it, or you can go really deep into it. So yeah, you guys have done an amazing job of meeting folks where they are at and repurposing the content in all these different forms that are digestible for people that are have different ways of learning or interacting with this information. So yeah, really, really brilliant way of delivering this information and also making it fun and accessible, which is, you know, also part of what I'm trying to do with Cocktails and Capitalism. You know, make it a little bit more of a party, bring a drink and everything. It's not just like I'm here to lecture you folks about everything, you know. So, yeah, it's I love that you bring the joy element as well to even just the method that you have of distributing this information. Mm-hmm. It's very cool. I wanted to pivot to talking a little bit about what a Beautiful Trouble training would look like. Like, what happens in these trainings?
Yeah. So along the way, people said, oh, it's nice you wrote this book and made this website, but can you come teach me how to make a giant puppet? Can you show me how to organize a flash mob? We were getting calls from fast food worker unions, from teachers, from grassroots organizations and national nonprofits saying, you know, how do I create a guidelines for my staff to participate in nonviolent direct actions? Or how do we get more people-powered movement building support happening within our organization or faith institution? And so we created this training network really by necessity. And a lot of us who were writers for the book became some of the first trainers, and it's expanded since then, of course. And I would say we're in good company with other direct action training networks, folks like Training for Change or Wildfire, And we really, our secret sauce is to help people understand what are the tools that make up the creative actions that they want to build or be part of, and why. Mm-hmm. You know, I will say, I think, you know, what part of your secret sauce in this show is you're getting us drinking so we can share our truest secrets, right?
So not so secret sauce right here.
So I'll say, you know, honestly, Erica, that a lot of people call us wanting to know about a sexy tactic. Hmm. And that's the Trojan horse. People want to hear about how do I create this cool action that's going to go viral on social media. And mm-hmm. our job is to come in and say, that's great that you want to do that fun creative action, but how is it going to help you escalate strategically, right? Going back to my falsely mixed drink here. uh-huh. You know, how can that creative action help you win? You know, not just get news headlines, but how can that help you build people power, create more points of entry for more people to get involved in your cause, or inspire people to imagine a world that's possible beyond mm-hmm. what they currently can conceive of, or motivate a target to take a different course of action, you know? So we really want to be thinking about why are we doing these creative actions? And I think what Tony Cade Bambara said, the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible.
I love that so much.
And so that, you know, how are we embodying that in our actions and in mm-hmm. the ways we treat each other, honestly, you know? And so that's our trainings, is we're really trying to show up in a responsive way and meet the need for people wanting to inject creative direct action, strategic campaign planning, and also street smarts into mm-hmm. what they do. You know, I'd be happy to give you kind of a taste of that secret sauce right now if you want to play along.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Let's go.
So great. I will ask you just if you might reflect on what's one of the actions that you've witnessed, or maybe you saw it on TV or you were part of it, that felt like a success for some reason to you.
I wanted to bring up this one action that I participated in as a student because I feel like I haven't heard other people talking about this tactic or this strategy at all elsewhere. We staged a kiss-in. So to kick the recruiters off campus, we had a bunch of activists pair up into same-sex couples and make out in front of the recruiter's booth. And basically, we were all making out there so that we completely blocked off the recruiter's booth. No one could even, you know, sign up or anything like that. And we just kept making out for hours until they left. So it was a fun, bizarre, sexy, like silly. We just had the best time. And even practicing for this, we were just like giddy and having so much fun, you know. So it was a really interesting creative tactic. But yeah, I was so curious if you've heard of other people doing kiss-ins or if this is a thing that other people do.
Love this as a tactic. It absolutely should be written up in our toolkit, the tactic of a kiss-in instead of a sit-in or stand-in, right?
This is incredible. Pre-COVID time, though, so that's a little bit, that's a little rougher, but.
Know thy kissing partner. Mm-hmm. Test and I'm curious to ask you, what was the response of passersby, or did you get media attention, or?
We got some media attention. People were incredibly amused by what was happening. It was, you know, people were entertained by what we were doing. So I think that was good. It definitely drew people's attention. I think there were a few people that were frustrated that they couldn't, you know, sign up, be recruited. But for the most part, I think the response was pretty good. And this was pre the university really ramping up its repression tactics. So I think we got away with doing this without a ton of like police backlash or anything. So that was, it actually worked really well. They left campus. We got them off. It felt like a great victory. So the fact that we were able to do that just by making out with fellow comrades was like, this is awesome.
Well, that's an amazing story, you know. So in the context of a training, we would just like, maybe we'd act out that story so we could kind of get a felt sense in our bodies of what does that look like? What's the tone? What's the feeling? Does it look inviting? Does it look scary? Does it look awesome? And then we would together kind of do a speed critique and think about what made it successful. And you've already done a bit of that, you know, that it felt creative, it felt sexy, it felt fun. Maybe it was attention getting, it was unusual or not something you would see. I would just add one from our toolbox, this idea of putting your target in a decision dilemma, you know, so you have the campus police or security or whoever was called, you know, do they want to arrest people for making out? Now you're arresting people for not technically doing something illegal. So, you know, and if they don't arrest you, are they supporting the free speech message that's being portrayed there against the military? Mm-hmm. So and I should say not against the military. I think you were protesting against an illegal war, really. You know, so that's an interesting one. Do the media's work for them is another principle in our toolbox, which is, you know, kind of like we think of John and Yoko Ono doing a bed in. Where they stayed in bed protesting the war in Vietnam. And that lent itself to great photos, right? The media didn't need to do anything. Show up and take a photo of John and Yoko Ono. I think similar in your action, you know, the media has a spectacle. They can take a photo of it. It's interesting. It's exciting. It's what's going on there, you know?
Totally.
And you've created a juxtaposition of kind of making out versus making war.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, love versus war. And so it's a you're putting the public in a decision dilemma too. And if the recruiters were to oppose this, they would be opposing love, connection, you know. I mean, it just it's interesting in that regard. We also have a principle called prefigurative intervention, which is this idea that by protesting, we can also show the world we want to see. So we think about, for example, the folks in the Midwest of the United States who did these blockades to try to stop the Keystone Pipeline from being built. And some people did a blockade in the middle of a farm where they were building a barn with solar panels. And they were showing, you know, if we didn't have this pipeline, we could be harnessing the power of the sun, of wind power, of other ways of fueling both the food we need to eat and also fueling our economy, right? Yeah. And so in this action, I think you're showing, well, this is another way that society creates safety and builds protection is by caring for one another, by loving up one another, by having fun, right? Like this is you're showing this is what we want instead is people connecting with each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've through the story, you've teased out a new tactic and then you've also created a web to existing principles and tactics.
Oh, I love that so much. And I love the concept of a decision dilemma. I'm going to think about that a lot going forward. I've definitely I haven't had the words to describe it, but I've definitely said it in many other words before. You know, we need to create those decision dilemmas for people so that they are in that sticky place of really showing their cards and, you know, showing if they want to side with love here or with war here.
So. Well, you know, Howard Zinn said you can't be neutral on a moving train. And so, you know, we say, you know, you got to choose the side you're on, which is not about a partisan sides, but it's the side of love and justice or the side of violence or oppression or planetary destruction. I will just say, I'll come out on the show and say that I have participated in a kiss-in at a recruiting station.
What? So this isn't something, okay. I didn't know that anyone had done
this. I mean, this is very Californian and we both are in California.
Yeah.
But this was at the Berkeley recruiting station circa, must have been 2007, I want to say, or early 2008. And the Daily Show actually came and filmed us. It was an action that Code Pink organized. And there were a bunch of couples making out and saying, make out, not war. And one of the co-founders of Code Pink turned to me and said, you know, Ray, we need you to get in there and make out with someone. And then girlfriend and I at the time went and made out in public, which was our first time doing that at a protest. And that kiss was on the Daily Show. John Stewart.
God, what? It.
And that is my queer coming out story.
Oh my God, that's the best queer coming out story I've ever heard by far. That's amazing.
Wow. In the name of stopping a war.
Yeah. Oh my God. You couldn't have done it in a more beautiful and amazing and exciting way. Wow, bravo. Cheers to that.
Yes. We'll drink with you to that.
Man, when we talk and we find the commonalities with our background, I get so much joy out of that. When we found out that we were both at Think Outside the Bomb conference, back in, probably 2008 or something like that. When would that have been?
Earlier, 2005.
2005. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Did you want to say anything else about the Beautiful Trouble trainings?
Yeah, I would just add that, in addition to Beautiful Trouble zooming into the classroom or flying somewhere for a training from Puerto Rico to Myanmar, we also, literally did want to give away the store and created this toolkit that you can download for free online. It's called BATMO, Beautiful Action Trainers Modules. And so it's a card deck for facilitators and trainers who want to skill up on how to teach about nonviolent direct action. Wow. And you can download that on our website. And then you just print out the cards yourself and has all these different modules. They're all linked to Google Docs. So we're updating them all the time. And we just came out with a new module that's about resilience and how do we take care of ourselves and our collectives amidst so much ongoing strife in the world and frankly within our organizations and the ever-present cancel cultures and things we live in. So how do we take good care of ourselves? One of our principles is be careful with each other so we can be dangerous together.
Oh, I love that. Wow. I want to see that on a shirt. That's so nice.
Yes, really, it should be. I think we're constantly trying to think not just about how can we show up and provide a training, but also how can we train trainers and equip others to do these trainings, especially on the fly, because sometimes you need to organize a protest in a few days. We had a group of women calling us from the capital of Colorado, from Denver, saying we need to organize an action against gun violence immediately. We just had yet another mass shooting in our community. How do we do it? So we couldn't get to Denver. It was the middle of the pandemic. But we were able to help these folks skill up from a distance.
Wow.
So whether it's a hotline, we had a resistance hotline. People call a 1-800 number. They get advice for direct actions. Or this BATMO toolkit, or just constantly trying to think of ways that how do we help people get training, really. Yeah. That makes a difference when we can act out and model and use these different tactics and techniques to see how to more effectively create change and how to deal with the opposition.
Amazing. I'm curious, what people in what situations should reach out to you about trainings?
That's a great question. We get a lot of requests from organizations from grassroots to national nonprofits. We can do customized consulting and training for big organizations that want to ally better with people-powered movements, to unions who are planning a series of creative actions or a day of action, and they want to figure out how to do that most strategically within their campaign, to grassroots groups wanting to learn how do I do a guerrilla projection or make a massive banner. So we really try to secure funding to be able to offer trainings on a sliding scale and to meet people where they're at. And I also think it's exciting when professors at very mainstream universities contact us and say, can you come in and help us learn from the Beautiful Trouble book in a one-time lecture? Or we were fortunate to work with an amazing professor at the New School in New York City, Jeremy Varen, on first ever semester-long curriculum based in Beautiful Trouble, where the students actually got to create their own actions and try them out during the course of the class.
Amazing. I love that you have that application element there. Very cool. So we had previously talked about kind of bringing up some real life examples that kind of make some of these tactics and strategies more concrete and accessible for people. So I wanted to just kind of open up the floor for you to talk about some stories that were most important to highlight here, including the Salt March in India and the battle in Seattle to shut down the World Trade Organization meeting that was happening there. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about these amazing actions?
Well, as the host of a podcast about capitalism, I'm not surprised you jumped to these two stories. Great examples, Erica. let's take the Salt March first. You know, this is one folks might be familiar with, Gandhi and the movement for freedom and independence for Indian people from British colonial rule, decided to escalate their tactics to go on a march, or what we could call a trek. That's one of the tactics in Beautiful Trouble, and to create their own salt from seawater instead of continuing to buy salt that was being taxed heavily by the British. So it was people saying, we are going to take our money out of the occupying power and we're going to make our own. We could go back to that prefigurative intervention. Let's build the world we want to see by making our own salt and really actually demonstrating what independence feels like, right? And they did this trek, and the trek allowed them to engage communities all along the path until they got to this culminating moment where, again, they put the British occupying powers in a decision dilemma. Are you going to stop people from going down on the beach and harvesting salt water and making their own salt? I mean, how absurd is that for police to do that, you know? Really important action in the very long struggle for India to get its independence from the British Empire. You know, that's divesting, really.
Totally. I wanted to just add that the collection of salt, it was made illegal. The Salt Act made it illegal for anyone to collect or produce salt except for the authorized British nationals. So this was really a radical act that they were doing, but from what I read about it, you know, they were actually laughed at about using this tactic, the strategy, but it was very successful. Why was it so successful?
Yeah, it makes me think about that line from that time. You know, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then you win. And I think, you know, part of the success is that civil disobedience, that direct confrontation with power and that decision dilemma of saying we're going to do it anyway, and the mass power behind it and Gandhi's reputation by that point and going ahead with it, but also not seeing that particular moment in isolation from all the other organizing that had been happening. You know, sometimes people will look at a moment like the Salt March or Rosa Parks sitting down on the bus or the occupation of Tahrir Square in Egypt and see it as like that was the thing that created the justice or the victory. But it's part of a larger narrative, larger story, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But I'm curious, you know, what else? What makes it successful for you, or what do you read into that story?
I mean, going back to the concept of the decision dilemma that you brought up, it just exposing the powers that be as ridiculous for trying to suppress some kind of action that you are taking part in. Like, that is so important to kind of reveal to the world that these repressive powers are using the power in bad ways. That's why, like, I also really appreciated when they did the mass direct action to stop Cop City. It was a nonviolent action very deliberately, so that anything that the police did would expose how ridiculous the repressive tactics were. Because if the activists were out there being wild and then the police come in with brutal tactics, that people can in their mind say, oh yeah, that's why they did that. But if people are acting peacefully, marching peacefully, and then the police come and try to shut you down and pepper spray you and bring their brutality, it just reveals the reality of this carceral state and how violent it is. That's kind of my main takeaway there.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And something for us to think about now is these historic examples of nonviolent resistance, whether it's the Salt March or, you know, the march in Birmingham, Alabama, where you have, you know, water cannons and dogs unleashed on peaceful protesters. The stark contrast between the peaceful demonstrators and the response of authority and power was very dramatic and was part of getting people who were neutral or not already engaged in the issue to wake up and join the cause, right?
Definitely. Definitely.
And we now have examples where activists are being treated with the utmost levels of brutality, and the media cycle is moving so fast and people are maybe shocked or wowed for a minute, but then we move on. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, we have to be thinking about what kind of tactics can we continue to engage in, where people are able to take appropriate risks and where there's an engagement strategy for what happens next. And mm-hmm. and I'm really thinking about our comrades in Palestine, frankly, yeah. who have been engaging in nonviolent civil resistance for many decades and who are often brutally repressed with tear gas and open fire and skunk guns and all the kinds of things. The Western media often has been unfazed or unmotivated to cover those stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, we can get all into Palestine, but yeah.
yeah, definitely. And I mean, it makes me think about the Great March of Return and how that was a peaceful march right. and they were being shot at in the legs or elsewhere. And that was very revealing about the Zionist entity and what it is willing to do to peaceful protesters, to peaceful Palestinians.
Yeah, that's right. I think Palestinian creative nonviolent resistance is very inspired by histories of nonviolent resistance elsewhere. And then mm-hmm. you just see this disproportionate response of Israeli occupying yeah. forces. And Palestinian creative nonviolent resistance inspires so much creative action in other parts of the world, too.
Yes, definitely. I don't know if you wanted to talk at all about the amazing story that you had brought to my attention about the like avatar protests in Palestine. Do you want to bring that up here or?
Sure. Yeah, you know, the history of Palestinian creative nonviolent resistance is so long. I mean, the occupation of Palestine has been going on for over 75 years, as we know, since 1948. Over the many, many, many years, so many different tactics, probably every tactic in the Beautiful Trouble toolbox you could reference a different yeah. Campaign or action in Palestine that's used that tactic. And one of the actions was after the movie Avatar came out. There was a group of Palestinian activists who painted themselves blue like the avatars and did a whole demonstration with puppets and protests in the West Bank trying to stop the expansion of the wall and the severing of Palestinian villagers from their livelihoods, ancestral mm-hmm. lands, and farming. And just making that point of being the indigenous peoples of the land and yeah. trying to elicit sympathy and compassion. After October 7th, there was an article in the New York Times written by, I believe, a Palestinian author named Hala. And the title of the article was "Why Must Palestinians Audition for Your Empathy?" So this kind of action is creative. It captivates our imaginations. It plays on pop culture, right? It's kind of a culture hack. And it shows like why would we be more sympathetic to a Disney character like an mm-hmm. avatar than to an everyday human being just struggling for their freedom? You know, exposes that amount of racism and anti-Arab hate that's out there that doesn't allow some people from seeing when a person just like themselves is just trying to get to work or go to school or have a baby or whatever, you know, that mm-hmm. the occupation is disrupting. But there are some incredible writers out there on the many, many nonviolent tactics that Palestinians have done over the years. I know after October 7th, my Beautiful Trouble comrade Nadine Block and I wrote an article for Waging Nonviolence about this, where we were talking about the exhaustion of so many tactics and how it doesn't matter kind of what Palestinian resistance looks like. It's just met with this unbelievable brutality, right?
Yeah.
One of my favorite actions that happened in Gaza was a mass action of children flying kites to break the Guinness Book of World Records for number oh, yeah. of kites flown. And then the Guinness certifier had to get himself into Gaza, which was a whole ordeal, right? Exposing wow. how hard it is to get through the blockade. And they did successfully break the Guinness Book of Records. And, you know, it's hard to look back on that action. It gives me like a hopeful heart. And we also don't know how many of the children who were flying kites that day and that beautiful sunny day on the beach in Gaza, you know, how many of those kids aren't here anymore, have yeah. been killed in the last 5 months.
Yeah. I think about the images of the videos that I've seen of children flying kites and there's like things raining down on them from the sky. Like, I think there was one video that I saw that was like white phosphorus and children flying kites. Like, what the hell is this world that we're living in? Just, yeah. So heart-wrenching.
Yeah, there's a Palestinian term, sumud. It's the Arabic term for steadfastness. And that steadfastness to keep on living your life, or it's one of the principles in Beautiful Trouble says, making daily life a protest amidst so much a brutal oppression.
Amazing.
And using humor to undermine the authorities and trying everything, really, trying everything. And I think because we're talking about capitalism here, it's important to acknowledge that after trying so many different tactics, nonviolent resistance, armed resistance, the Intifada, so on, there was a group of Palestinian civil society came together in 2005, right? And they created this call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And over the last almost 20 years, people have been organizing these nonviolent economic pressure campaigns to basically say, if the change won't happen from within, how can we as an international community take responsibility and pressure Israel from outside to stop oppressing Palestinian people using economic means? Because we know that money talks, right?
Yeah.
And it's been incredible to be involved in some of these boycott campaigns, the boycott of SodaStream or Ahava Cosmetics. And there's so many victories that have happened over the year. People, one of them in the Beautiful Trouble Toolkit, we have the story of Dump Veolia cutting the contracts with this huge French company that does business with settlements, or did business with the settlements. And, you know, getting churches to sign on to divest their pension funds from Caterpillar or Motorola or these other companies that are involved in the infrastructure of apartheid, and getting cities to say that they're going to be apartheid free. And right now we're seeing just a surge in interest in divestment and boycott. And I think those are very effective strategic ways if we're boycotting companies that are directly profiting from the occupation or part of that apartheid military security complex. Very helpful. You know, I live in the Bay Area in California, one of the fourth largest economies in the world, the state of California. We have Silicon Valley here. We have a very active campaign saying no tech for apartheid. And, you know, seeing these Google employees doing sit-ins is very inspiring.
Getting fired in mass, like, amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this Monday on April 15th, we had the global economic blockade for Palestine, and people around the world took part in this action, shutting down centers of commerce, airports, the Golden Gate Bridge, different transportation hubs. So it was an amazing success in that so many people participated, and it was completely decentralized. Like, it was not coordinated in a top-down sense. Everyone was doing it independently, but coming together at the same time. So I think that's a really important thing that we need to learn from, because in the age of like RICO charges for protesters, we need to know how to do actions without being able to get in trouble for being part of an organized movement or an organized group that is then more likely to be charged with RICO charges and things like that. So the decentralized nature of it was very, very exciting for me. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about how that all went down and lessons that we can take from it.
Yeah, I think another great example of a decentralized action is the Occupy Wall Street that was just popping up all over the world circa 2011, 2012. You know, this has been incredible to see the momentum building and building and building over the last 5 months of this atrocity going on. And you think to yourself, well, you know, what can I do in my lifetime to stop so much violence in this way? And again, money talks. And when we can target the economic system, power listens, right? Because I think often, unfortunately, given that we don't have campaign finance reform, given that we have corporate personhood in this country, politicians are weighing their odds. They're hedging their bets. How much money will I lose from my campaign if I do the will of the people? You know, from the weapons industry or the tech industry or pharmaceutical industry or whatever. Conversely, if I don't do the will of the people and I take the money, how many votes am I going to lose? Can I still safely get elected? You know, that's the equation that we're in. And when we disrupt business as usual, we're trying to send a message to those lawmakers and powers that be that there is no business as usual, right? That we're not taking it anymore and that we have collective power. We forget how much power we have. You know, some people might be familiar with that old graphic of, you know, the big fish is eating all the little fish and then all the little fish get together and they eat the big fish, you know, and I heard someone say recently at a gathering, let's not forget that you might be swimming as one of those little fish right nearby your ex-partner or someone that annoys the heck out of you. You need to stay in that formation and get it done to eat that big fish. Right. Yes. And so it's like, we have a principle of beautiful trouble. If you're not uncomfortable, your coalition is too small. So, I love that you're bringing up this action that happened this last week and in many ways is continuing. I think it's particularly strategic when people are disrupting economic systems of injustice. So when we see the block the boat action where people are saying the longshoremen and activists on the piers are refusing to allow a ship carrying weapons to Israel to depart. That's really significant, right? I think this is all part of, you know, going back to that salt march that Gandhi and the Indian National Congress helped to organize, that that concept of satyagraha, of nonviolent protest, you know, and how do we take ourselves out of being part of the problem, you know? And I think something that I've learned from one of the most brilliant economic activism researchers I know, Dr. Dov Baum, works with American Friends Service Committee. She always teaches about the difference between a clean hands boycott and a strategic boycott, right? So, you know, the idea of being this morally righteous person or this fictitious idea that you can be pure and that you can extract yourself, you know, just give me a list of all the things to boycott so I don't have to be complicit in Israel's war crimes, or so I don't have to be complicit in the killing of animals, or so I don't have to be complicit in the fill in the blank. That is probably not going to happen because we live in a capitalist world and we are interconnected. And we can't fully divest ourselves. We could, unless we're off the grid, you know, living in a cave. Conversely, a strategic boycott is saying, what can we collectively put pressure on to send a message to the industry or the powers that be as a whole? So I love the example here in California of the farm workers, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, United Farm Worker Movement, saying we are boycotting Delano grapes. They didn't say don't eat any grapes. They picked on that one company that was particularly egregious to send a message to the whole industry that farm workers have rights, that farm worker lives matter, that we need to be taking care of the people who are growing our food in a better way, right? And it made them, you know, we talk about the principle of making the invisible visible. All of a sudden, someone sees a package of grapes at the grocery store and they're thinking about those farm workers who are planting and picking and tending those grapevines, right? Whereas before they were just thinking, oh, you know, do these grapes look ripe? Is my kid going to like to eat them? Whatever, right? And so that's, you know, same thing with the Montgomery bus boycott, particular bus company. And I think we need to think about that right now around our BDS targets. And I can't recommend enough that folks, you know, who are interested in economic activism, go to the Boycott National Committee, go to the source, you know, this amazing Palestinian-led organization that maintains a list. So you can put in your country or your zip code and find out what are the campaigns that are realistic near me. And similarly, there's a whole list now online of the companies that are profiting from this current bombing of Gaza, you know, so we can really be targeted in our activism.
Yeah, that's so important. And I definitely am looking forward to connecting with them and talking about boycotts and strategic boycotts, because that's a very important concept. I mean, I want to boycott everything that might be involved in, you know, Israeli apartheid and genocide, but also we need to know where to all throw our weight so that actually it makes a difference and the companies actually feel the impact. So yeah, that's definitely a topic that I'm going to dive into more on the show. But we didn't get a chance to talk about the battle in Seattle. Did you want to just quickly kind of share a little bit about that? What happened and what was important to glean from that?
Yeah, I would be glad to talk about the battle in Seattle. You know, this was in 1999, this massive carnival of creative nonviolence where 70,000 protesters shut down the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle and had this major victory against neoliberalism and really helped to launch the global justice movement in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think at that time, a lot of people in this country had never even heard of the WTO. But people who were paying attention said, you know, whether we care about environment or human rights or labor issues, we need to pay attention to this massive organization that is doing this economic regulation. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the success there was you had people engaging creative street tactics on the outside, but then you also had an inside strategy where people were literally on the inside giving the message. And that time is important to reference, particularly for younger activists to learn about the history of anti-globalization and the critique of capitalism in this country, and to reckon with, frankly, the fact that we had this growing anti-imperialism movement that was set to protest the International Monetary Fund, I think on September 12th or September 13th of 2001. Wow. Just a couple years later, we were getting ready for that protest in Washington, D.C., and what happened a couple days before, right? 9/11 happened. And our country turned to, rightfully so, mourning lives who had been lost in that attack, but then to a massive anti-war move. And we focused our attention on Afghanistan and then Iraq and then drone attacks in Yemen and went down this whole rabbit hole of trying to stop the U.S. invasions and ongoing occupation of Iraq, which of course was always a war for oil, right? Yeah. So it was all based on keeping our economy going, business as usual. So you could say it's all interconnected. And at the same time, the anti-globalization movement, I think, lost some steam refocusing on the anti-war movement. And I think when we look at any social issue you care about, you pick an issue, you know, you care about the climate, you care about education, you care about access to healthcare, issues with opiates, you care about weapons manufacturers and stopping future wars, whatever it is, it traces back to this massive financial gain and the amount of money these corporations put into our elections. And I think something on the scale of the battle in Seattle is needed in terms of campaign finance reform and ensuring democratic elections. It just hasn't been as sexy of an issue to work on. And we get siloed in our issue areas. Mm-hmm. And I think what makes me hopeful is that right now, what we're seeing in the streets around the protests of the ongoing bombardment of Gaza is a very intersectional struggle where people are saying, I'm here because Black Lives Matter, or I'm here because I'm Filipino, or I'm here because I'm Jewish. I'm here because I care about the environment and war is not green. I'm here because I care about women and women and children are dying in Gaza, whatever it is. That's different to me than how anti-war marches looked in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that return to kind of a battle in Seattle where it's an all hands on deck moment and there's an intersectional gathering, I think is really needed.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm going to let you go really fast here, but I wanted to open up the floor for you to talk about the upcoming book, Beautiful Solutions.
Yeah, well, this is really what's next on deck for Beautiful Trouble. So Beautiful Trouble has put so much energy into documenting the tactics and tools needed to protest and to say no to the injustices in our world. And we connected with a group of amazing editors and activists who said, let's use that same toolbox framework and that way of parsing out values and principles and stories and write a book about the tools that we need to build the world we want to see. What are we saying yes to? And how do we say yes to it? And how do we build from the ground up? So they came together and started working with us on Beautiful Solutions, which is a toolbox for liberation. And it's an incredible collection of stories from all over the world about solidarity economies, and renewable energy and cooperatively owned schools and credit unions and cooperatively owned sports teams. There's a story about radical grandmas who are using weaving to build revenue for their movement work in Thailand. There's incredible, inspiring stories there so that we can say we're not only doing the beautiful trouble, we're not only resisting, but we're also building. And how do we build together? Mm-hmm. And there's an accompanying curriculum. This is a project that's being co-led by Beautiful Trouble, New Economy Coalition, Highlander Center in the South, and the People's Hub. And it's really become a legacy project for one of the co-editors, Alandria E. Williams, who was an incredible queer activist of blessed memory who passed on during the pandemic years. And this project really honors them and their work. And it's co-edited by a wonderful team, Rachel Plattis, Eli Figali, and Nathan Schneider, and will, inshallah, hopefully be released by OR Publishers, who are our same publisher we've had for all our books later this year. So we, sometimes projects take twists and turns and you don't know how you're going to get to that vision you're holding. And it takes a lot longer than you think, but we're really committed to getting this project done and to getting this content out there. And then again, just like Beautiful Trouble, having a living library online where people can add their own case studies, stories of how they're building the world they want to see. And I think when we look at that, it's really a question of scale and how are we, you know, creating scalable change. You know, it's one thing to have a cooperative exchange in your small town, and it's another thing to have a national company like Mondragon. And so how do we learn at all those different scales?
Definitely. Yeah, that is so important. I mean, I'm so glad that in addition to talking about how to tackle some of the problems in the world, the strategies and tactics that we need to address the injustices that we're seeing, but then also we need to shift from just that and being on the defensive to being actually building the thing that we want to live in, the world that we want to live in. So I'm so glad that this book is coming out and I can't wait to read it. I just wanted to let you do some plugs and calls to action or anything else where people can find you before I let you go.
So if folks want to check out Beautiful Trouble, find us online, beautifultrouble.org. Access our toolbox at the same URL, beautifultrouble.org/toolbox. You can find us on Instagram, on Facebook, and across all social media platforms where you are. We love to take creative actions that are happening right in the moment and break down for you what are the tools and tactics that are making them successful. So check our social media for the latest and greatest and send us your action ideas. We really want to hear from you and hear what you're up to. We have a Get Up, Rise Up Direct Action Fund. Right now we're funding actions that are specifically calling for a ceasefire and actions that are working on climate justice. So we give out these very small micro grants to people who are trying to organize direct actions once a month.
Amazing.
And we want to hear your stories and add your content to our growing library of tools for change and to imagine together what this other world that's possible could look like. Right?
Yeah, definitely. And I know that all the listeners out there are beautiful troublemakers or beautiful troublemakers in the making, you know? So yeah, this is going to be a wonderful resource for all of them.
One thing before I forget.
Yeah.
You know, as we're talking about boycott and divestment of the state of Israel and its illegal, unjust, apartheid system of oppression of Palestinian people, I want to say loud and clear that when we are calling for economic activism to pressure Israel to uphold international law, we are not calling for a boycott of Jews. And that actually, as a Jewish person myself with family in Israel, I think it's the most Jewish thing we could do to use nonviolent tactics to embody our ethics and to support freedom and equality and dignity for all people. So we need to separate out always when we talk about ending apartheid, the critique of the Zionist regime from anything that is anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish. And to me, there's nothing more Jewish than getting involved in a peaceful protest to support people's freedom of speech, free rights, and in collective liberation. We're in the season of going toward Passover right now, which is a time of celebrating collective liberation. So I feel like it's important for me to say that.
I'm really glad you added that. I'm very happy to see that so many people are understanding that difference very clearly, and that this is something that is like being disseminated amongst our society. You know, at least the younger folks, they are understanding the difference there very clearly, and that gives me a lot of hope. So, but yeah, thank you for just sharing that and sharing how you're personally kind of connected to this as well. Well, shall we close this with a divination from the card deck?
Sounds great. So I have the Beautiful Trouble card deck spread out in front of me here. I'm going to say when I start, and then you just tell me when to stop, and I will pull the card, and we will divine the future for the Cocktails and Capitalism podcast.
Awesome. All right, you going?
I'm going to start. You tell me when to stop.
And stop.
Okay, this card is Joy is a Revolutionary Force.
Yes.
Protests can be fun. Find pleasure in the process and let your creativity and joy guide you. As Adrienne Marie Brown said, feeling good is not frivolous. It is freedom.
Oh,
so
that is
a beautiful note to end on.
What a great note to end on. Cheers to that, man. Oh, my gosh.
Cheers to that.
And to Adrienne Marie Brown, too, who was on the show. Oh, well, thank you for that. That was awesome. And I can't wait to do my own divinations when I have the card deck as well. It's pretty
yes,
cool.
Definitely.
I'll have to make do it sure live on Instagram it. At some point. But so thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing the work of Beautiful Trouble. It is really amazing to be in community with you folks and able to share some of the lessons that you were distilling from this world, this messed up world, and all the beautiful actions that are taking place in it. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Erica. We'll see you in the streets.
Okay, awesome. Cheers and solidarity.
Cheers. <Yay. laughs> You distill the spirit, we'll distill the actions.
Thank you so much for tuning into this anti-capitalist project. To remain independent and free from the corrupting influence of corporations, Cocktails and Capitalism has rejected the corporate advertising model. Instead, we've decided that the only ethical approach to funding our work is through the kind, supportive listeners like you and revolutionary groups that embody our values. This show was sponsored by Beautiful Trouble, an international network of organizers, artists, and trainers working to equip grassroots movements with the tools to become more creative, effective, and irresistible. If you value the work that we're doing here at Cocktails and Capitalism, we would deeply appreciate any amount you're able to contribute through Patreon, even if it's only a dollar a month. This project involves a massive amount of research, networking, content creation, and editing, all of which has been done by myself and a small team of volunteers. None of us have been paid for our time and labor, but I hope to make this work more financially sustainable in the future. You can lend a hand by signing up on Patreon or by purchasing merch through my friend shop, Punk with a Camera, which I've linked in the show notes. For those of you who are unable to contribute financially, which is totally understandable in this fucked up economy, you can still support the show by giving us a rating and writing a review on Apple and Spotify. Big thanks to John, our producer and audio editor, Jesse Torres, our resident anti-capitalist bartender, Dread, our video editor, and Anthony, who's been helping me with social media. To all of our existing patrons, thank you so goddamn much. Your support truly helps to keep this anti-capitalist independent media project alive. Much love to you all. Cheers and solidarity forever.